Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Stop.
Hi, welcome to the AI Movie Night. I almost said AI Comic Pod because I'm so used to saying that now. I'm your host, Rory Greenfield. I've got with me, as per the last pod, Luke Chandley and Simon Dowling, and we're talking more about David Fincher. We last discussed Zodiac, which is Simon's pick, and Luke's pick was just Skin of the Teeth, Social Network. I'm going to talk about my pick, and then we will, Luke, let you talk about Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, and we will talk about Seven and do some questions as well. I couldn't do this podcast without talking about Fight Club, and remarkably, up until in the whole of part one, we barely touched on the subject. Fight Club, for me, is one of the most defining films of my generation. It covers subject matters which, you know, it's obviously on a very bold scale, but it does cover mental health and it does cover people in difficult situations. And it does cover what people maybe are driven to from the kind of boredom and, you know, difficulty of modern society and modern living. It's kind of fighting in the face of everything it says in the film about people collecting every page of the IKEA furniture catalogue and and all the kind of difficulties of working those kind of jobs and conforming as such, and what Edward Norton's incredible performance delivers is a character that's basically wrestling with his own self-consciousness and ultimately becomes schizophrenic. Which, if you haven't seen Fight Club, please watch it before you listen to this, because there is a very big spoiler in this film which I've just delivered. Which Edward Norton and Brad Pitt are the same person, in the sense that, you know, he makes up Brad Pitt's character in his head and ultimately kind of goes down the line of becoming him by inventing Fight Club, inventing the kind of Project Mayhem, you know, is doing Helena Bonham Carter on the side in his own head, you know. I mean, it's quite an incredible performance, because the first time I watched it, I didn't know. And I think with internet being as it is now, would you have been spoiler free going into this? I probably doubt it. It's the kind of film that has got an incredible twist. And as much as you might start to click, I don't think you really ever. Well, I didn't. It was 99 it came out. So I was what, 15, 16? I think for me, I was too gullible. I wasn't falling, you know, straight into the trap of thinking, yeah, it's definitely the same guy. He's definitely Tyler Durden. until the moment he realizes, and for me, it just shocked me. And I just, you know, there's a lot to talk about this film. I'll let the guys talk a little bit, and then I'll talk more about it. But for me, it's just such an incredible film, and I've said incredible a lot recently on these podcasts, but it kind of covers everything I loved in the film. So it's got that kind of high octane, high energy. It's got quite high stakes for me because of what is going on around him. It's got an incredible, incredible soundtrack, capped off for me by an incredible Pixies song. And it's just the kind of film that really does make you wake up and pay attention. And it's produced in a typically kind of Fincher stylistic way, but very edgy and very dark at times. Some really kind of bold filmmaking, which I don't think I'd seen before watching this. And honestly, I not always, but you know, I haven't seen a lot of that since then, because it's almost 20 years old and it's still for me incredibly groundbreaking. So Simon, I'll come to you. What are your thoughts? This was close to being your pick, I think.
Yeah, I was very near to picking it. For me, it's probably like a little bit what you mentioned. It just reminds me of being around like maybe like 18. It just reminds me of that time of being young and wanted to kind of rebel a little bit and do my own thing. Well, not quite so far, you know. Maybe land off a couple of, you know, like a
mate, I wanted that
banger here or there.
I wanted that leather jacket when I was 18.
I was going to actually say that outfit that he wears is just so iconic. I mean,
it is, isn't it? Yeah,
it's just such a good outfit, and he wears it so well. I think that's probably my favorite Brad Pitt film. I think he's just so, it's like the epitome of him. I think he just plays that like he is him. It's just like, to me, he that's so Brad Pitt, you know?
Yeah, I think he just has that way that he Brad talks Pitt, or something. Yeah, I think he's just effortlessly cool, man, on in that film. Yeah. I think everyone looks at him and just goes, I'm my mate, and I'm not joking, my mate growing up basically cut his hair to try and look like Tyler Durden, bought a leather jacket and went to the gym a shitload to try, and he failed so badly. He gave it a good go, but you know, no one's emulating Brad Pitt in that role. And yeah, you're right. It's
the defining kind of,
performance of his career for me. Yeah.
I miss those kind of films that made you, like, I suppose it's kind of what it was, I just think of when you were a certain kind of an age and you were just very influenced by films. Like, I found like a film like that, and maybe something like Pulp Fiction would have just been films that lived with me, you know, at that time. They just had a massive effect on me. And also, I didn't read the book until a little bit after, but I'm a massive fan of the book, and I'm a massive fan of Chuck Palahniuk books. And I just think he's just such a weird, he like writes the weirdest books. And I just think he really captured just the spirit of that book and the spirit of that time. And most of his books are about that kind of thing as well. And it's just one of those films that it'd be very hard to not, that it wouldn't make like your top 10 films, you know. I just think it's just got so much in it, and it's dark, it's got humor, it's got meatloaf with man tits, you know, it's got what more do you want?
Bob with the bitch tits,
and
man.
The soundtrack is my favorite character. Bob is brilliant, and I just think that it just does everything right.
Yeah,
you know?
I think there's nothing bad in the film. No, I think you're spot on there, really. I mean, it's Helena Bonham Carter as well. I mean, Marla Singer growing up, I was like, my God, this woman's incredible. Do you know what I mean? As a 16-year-old boy, this woman who just speaks like that and just, I don't know, man, she's just effortlessly cool. She just, because she didn't give a shit. And I think when you're that age, she was just perfectly cast in it. I mean, she's an interesting actress, and obviously she's had this marriage with Tim Burton, an on-running relationship. But when she kind of steps out of the Tim Burton bubble and does films like this, she's quite remarkable. And as you said, I mean, Meatloaf, what inspired casting is that? I mean, what a character to think of. It's crazy to think of this juice head who was kind of had his own videos and took too many steroids and then ended up with this high-pitched voice and giant tits. It's just like the weirdest take, but almost he knows that I'm not, you know, but he knows he's delivering an element of comic, you know, comic kind of backdrop, dark black comedy. Obviously, it's very a comic film, but there's elements there where he's delivering that because he's that character. And when he comes to the house to kind of audition to get into Project Mayhem to pass the kind of recruitment thing where they have to stand there for 3 days and get hurled abuse at, he basically walks off
walks away
the steps after the first bit of abuse, and then he has to go back as Edward Norton. Rather
he's like, oh man,
no, Bob, just stay, you've got to stay, man, it's fine. it's like, just hilarious.
Part of the process, just wait a day.
Yeah, it's part of the process. Have you, don't run off.
Have you read the book?
No.
Be interesting. No. I think you should read the book.
I think I should. Yeah. I think I should. I didn't.
It complements the film. Oh really?
I didn't know it exactly. I didn't know it was based on a book. I think I might have done, but I've never thought of it to pay that point of attention. No.
But it's worth the I feel like it kind of works well with the book, if you know what I mean. Like it's not just like a bad book or a bad film. No, so it works really well.
Sometimes they do kind of run in harmony. I always said High Fidelity was one of those where I love the book and I love the film equally because they're quite different, but they're obviously the same in terms of what they cover. And there's occasions where it works. Luke, was it a rewatch? Oh, it was a rewatch today, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a rewatch. I honestly think the last time I saw it before, about 2 hours ago, was probably like 15 years ago. Like it was really long time ago. And so much so that I was like, I knew the twist. Like I did know it from pop culture, but at the same time, like you kind of doubt yourself. Like it's been that long, you kind of think, is that what happens? Like I'm gonna actually like have to properly pay attention.
I'm tempted to kick you off this pod, man. I can't believe you've not seen it for 15 years.
Just press the eject button just straight on the pod. Yeah. But and so I rewatched it today, and you just know like it is like the defining kind of Fincher film, so you've got to rewatch it before you come on. And I rewatched it almost from knowing the twist and taking a look at it, as in like how would the scenes cope
that's
having
why
knowing.
It's a great rewatch, man.
Yeah,
it's a great rewatch.
It's a lovely rewatch, yeah.
Because that's the part of it that's so clever. Like, there's not many films where it's got such a big reveal. Like, say, The Sixth Sense, which I think probably did it for a lot of people, where they go back and watch it and go, shit, he's not talking, you know, he's not in the room, or the mum can never see him. Do you know what I mean? He never interacts. Yeah. Where people don't get that the first watch. And it's the same with this film. You watch it second back and you go, shit, that makes so much sense. Because it is clever, because it does put you in the kind of Tyler Durden mindset. When he's Tyler, you do think he's a different character, and they show both on screen, and you, until the reveal, you're like, well, how could he be beating himself up, which he is, do you know what I mean? The initial scene in the car park and that famous scene in the bar kind of parking lot where he, you know, puts the beers down and they just have a fight, and then people start crowding around and watching. He's just kicking himself. He's just beating the shit out of himself. Do you know what I mean? And that's why people get that intrigue. They go, why the hell is this guy doing this? And then they just want that buzz. They just want to escape. You know, the reason it catches on and that, you know, Fight Club exists is because people, I don't know, want to feel something other than 9 to 5. I mean, like I said, there are some comedic elements to it. The part when they said you've got to start a fight with someone you don't know, and the guy's washing the cars and spraying the hose at the priest.
Yeah.
It is very funny. Across the kind of, you know, supermarket and trying to get, you know, knocks his paperwork or briefcase on the floor. It's just hilarious. There are scenes like that in it that really do get you. But ultimately, it revolves around Edward Norton. And I mean, I'm not going to use that I word again. It's an insanely good performance. He plays that haggard insomniac so well.
Yeah.
And as he degrades as the film goes on, you know, Tyler obviously almost gets better looking, Brad Pitt does, and he just gets more and more exhausted with the day-to-day living of things. And that's where his mind slowly starts to become Tyler, and almost he isn't in the same room as him, he blacks out for days on end, and you know, doesn't, you know, he feels one step behind in those kind of chase from one airport to the next and one town to the next scenes, because he's slowly losing control, and that's the part that is great. I mean, the iconic scenes in this, and there are tens of them. The scene ultimately where he leaves his job, I mean, he keeps going back into work. There's one point where he's just smoking. He's not got a tie on. He's got blood on his shirt. He's just literally past caring.
Is it the end of his tether, isn't he? Yeah,
yeah. He's literally gone. He doesn't give a shit. He's just doing whatever he wants. And he keeps saying that, you know, I got up in everyone's tiny little face and up their noses and stuff. He, you know, just doesn't give a shit. And he's making photocopies of Fight Club to hand out in the fax machine. It's just... he just doesn't care. And then the scene ultimately where he's getting compensation, you know, he comes to the conclusion he can't work there anymore. That's it over. And he acts like his boss has kicked the shit out of him. And that's clever on a lot of levels, because obviously it's quite funny, it's quite bold, and those elements. But ultimately he's done that while at the same time he's just been kicking the shit out of himself in Fight Club at the beginning and in that other car park scene towards the culmination of the film. And you don't clock, I don't think. I didn't clock it, do you know what I mean? And then when you watch it, you go, Christ, this guy's really good at beating himself up, you know, quite dramatically. And it's clever because there's a lot of parts of the film where you should trigger and you should get it, but you just don't. And I mean, that shocked me. It really did. Simon, what's your kind of take on? Do you remember when you first watched it in that regard?
I was shocked. I was just like, I couldn't believe it. It was just such a huge thing. It's like, it's just one of those times you're just watching the film and that bit kind of comes up and you're just like, how? You're just like, what? It makes you rethink the whole film then. But what's in, like, definitely very interesting to watch it back when you know the twist, because Helena Bonham Carter's character always kind of picks up on it and is like, what kind of, like,
why, you know, why, like, you be like, oh, with me?
Why are you being weird,
or the, like, morning after talking to it?
Yeah. So it's kind of her who you kind of think there's something weird. And also, I don't know if this is a thing that I picked up the first time I watched, but when I re-watched it, Brad Pitt appears on the screen in little bursts before he appears in the film. Did you guys pick up on that?
Yeah,
this little,
you know what they say about his character. So he was the guy that he had two jobs, Tyler Durden, quite famously, and he made soap as a third job.
Yeah.
So he made soap and sold it. He sold their asses, fat asses, back to them, is what they said in the film, which is great. And then he also was the guerrilla terrorist of the restaurant world, where he, you know, pissed in the soup and I don't know what they say about the cream of the soup or whatever. And then his other job was working in a cinema late at night and cutting scenes into films.
So he kind of puts himself,
and they call it a cigarette burn, where it's like a moment in the film where you just see a trigger point in the top of a screen, where the scene is cut from one to the next. And the famous in the film is when he's put it, basically implying it was Tom and Jerry, and he put a big fat cock in the middle of the scene. And everyone knew, even though it was only on scene for a second, everyone knew what they'd seen. And all the kids are crying in the audience. That's what it's implying. So those points where
it's very strange, isn't it?
Clicks him in and out like he's coming into his consciousness. I think there's one you clock. There was one I clocked the first time I watched it, but I think most of the time you don't, and that happens quite a lot in that film.
It's strange, isn't it?
It's a great rewatch, though. And actually, do you know what? Every time I rewatch it, there's probably something else in there I might have missed.
Definitely. Yeah, so I see that.
I read something very strange about the film, which I hadn't ever heard before, which I just found earlier on. Apparently, there's a Starbucks cup visible in every single scene in the film. throughout the whole film. There's Starbucks, which is
that
insane.
That surprises me. Isn't that crazy? There's a lot of scenes that make sense with that, because there are a lot of city scenes and a lot in the offices, and yeah, there's a bit around obviously there's a lot of flying in and out of airports and stuff. I can't imagine there's a Starbucks cup in the kitchen, because they're in that kitchen of that derelict house quite a lot.
It'd be interesting to
actually
see if that's true.
I'd be intrigued by it. And
he's claimed, apparently he said it himself.
Okay, you know. Well, it's probably so maybe. And it is about consumerism. I mean, the whole film is about that, though, isn't it? That's what
the subtleties of it and all the little
And ultimately, the guy goes to the point of blowing up his own condo because he's trying to escape, that life. Do you know what I mean? And that's the extremes he goes to, and then basically goes and lives in a derelict house. And it's just it's crazy. You're right. The scenes with Marla, which is like the night after, the morning after the night before, are really clever. And I don't know why I didn't trigger, but
I think you just think that she's a bit mad.
She's a bit mad.
So like you don't really think that it's actually her who's the one who's seen, you know, sense.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously the scenes where you see where they're having sex, it's never implied it's him. He's always out the room, you know, he's always visible to it. You can always hear it. But they show him in different parts of the house you're right, it is very clever. I mean the scene quite pivotal in it is when Brad Pitt's speaking for him, and he's kind of in the basement steps, and she's kind of she's questioning him more, and he's starting to backtrack a little bit, and he says this conversation is over. Do you know what I mean? And he basically, it's Brad Pitt protecting
speaking
his
kind
own
of
identity.
For, yeah.
It's protecting that Tyler Durden basically. But the moment when he calls her and says, you know, what's my name? And she says, Tyler Durden, Tyler Durden, Tyler Durden. And it triggers at that point after he'd gone to that other city. And the guy said, you know, look, don't speak to me about this. And it's so clever. And the guys in Project Mayhem aren't backing down. And in the police station, as you mentioned, where it's like, you know.
You can't speak about it. Yeah. Don't speak about Project Mayhem.
Yeah, don't speak about Project Mayhem. But it said, you know, Tyler would say you'd say this. And he definitely said you'd say that.
That's a really funny bit. Yeah, I think that might be like my... I think that's the funniest scene, because it is that bit where the bigger lad says, oh no, we definitely say you said that. And it's like, and it's like, it's just so great. You kind of think he's never going to get out of this situation. Like he's built this for himself. It's really, really, really funny.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I know Luke, you missed the ending, and we did briefly talk about it before you came on. But the ending, I mean, for me is quite a big David Fincher ending to a film. He ultimately goes to the point of shooting a gun in his mouth, surviving incredibly and feeling almost all right, despite the fact he can almost blow his throat off and can barely speak. And the whole of the city is blowing up around them because of the bombs they've set. And it's kind of, I don't know, it's crazy. It's a full cycle. And he's there with Marla in the kind of ruins of what's gone on before. And it's almost a happy ending, despite being a really fucked up film. Do you know what I mean? you don't think long term what is going to happen, but ultimately it's the guy that's kind of come to control of his own mind, and that's all that matters to him. Do you know what I mean? And we said it before, and you'll hear the song coming into these podcasts, which is it's Pixies' "Where Is My Mind," and it just the soundtrack in this is really good. It's I can't remember who produced it, but it's kind of heavy bass, lots of beats, not lyric kind of songs based until Pixies kicks in, and it really does define the kind of film. And like you say, stylistically, it's probably the coolest film I've ever seen. I'd put it in that category.
Yeah. So I was rewatching it, and I think the reason it took me so long to kind of rewatch it was I think I was just at that age where, like you said, I hadn't really matured, I don't think, as a film fan. And it's kind of, I think it's quite long. It's got messages that aren't overly obvious. And at points it kind of not as obvious that there's something between Tyler and the unnamed character. But you do go, yeah, what? And then you get, but then the film moves on, and you're kind of like, oh well, whatever. I've got to crack on with watching the film. And it's, I think it's that thing. But I think actually, rewatching it at the moment, I think it's very, it's kind of almost like, and in just in like a really weird, like 6 degrees of separation, where it's kind of like for me, the American Trainspotting almost, in terms of it's very gritty. That's... it's about that. There's more to life, you know, choose life. There's a Trainspotting poster.
Yeah.
It's kind of about that, isn't it? There's more than, you know, give away all your items. There's more to life than consumerism. Gritty. Yeah. It's very grunge. I think even though the film was made in 99, it feels very 95, 96, post grunge, a bit dirty, a bit dark. Like you say, with the music is very beats orientated.
That's, you know, the kings of grunge are, the Pixies, man, for me. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So I think that's what I noticed as like a grown up film fan, like rewatching it. And it's really, like you say, it is very, very cool. And there's obviously complete differences with Trainspotting, but I just think that's kind of where it was coming from a little bit, mate.
No, well, not, it's a great shout. No, honestly, it is a great shout. Like we said, it is all about anti-consumerism. That's ultimately what the message of the story is.
Yeah.
But you're right. It does have that kind of, and it is bold and edgy, and you know, and gritty, and yeah, grungy. It's a good term, kind of, man.
It's kind of cool when it shouldn't be. Whereas like you watch Trainspotting and almost like, yeah, it was grim, but you're like, yeah, this is a bit cool, this, isn't it? And it is kind
like
of cool.
Like I said, most people idolise Brad Pitt in that film because they're just, God, this guy's effortlessly cool. I mean, despite the one look where he almost goes full snatch and he wears like, he shaved his head at the end and he's wearing the vest.
Oh yeah, that's towards the end, isn't it? Yeah.
That's not a great look. It's like he's gone from, you know, 90s grunge into 80s discotheque. It doesn't quite fit, but other than that, you think this guy's pretty damn cool. And you're right, I mean, some of the lines in it, and I'm just gonna run through a few because for me it was all the stuff that Tyler said, it just kind of hugged me. The scene on the plane when they first meet, it really gets me. And when Tyler's kind of going to the bathroom, he says, "Now a question of etiquette, as I pass, do I give her the ass or the crotch?" When he's passing the stewardess on the flight, which I just loved because that's almost your introduction to him. And we said about the kind of bar of soap. So Tyler sold his soap to department stores at $20 a bar. Lord knows what they charged. It was beautiful. We were selling rich women their own fat asses back to them. And there's a lot of the kind of, like you said, the kind of detrimental, darker kind of tones to it. So listen up, maggots, you are not special and you're not beautiful or unique snowflake. You are the same decaying organic matter as everything else. Yeah, and then this is your life and it's ending 1 minute at a time. There's loads, man. I mean, he has some pretty big lines in it, and it's cool when, you know, we haven't really even talked about the element of the Fight Club stuff. It's dark as hell. I mean, it's so violent at times.
Yeah.
The scenes when Brad Pitt is getting the shit kicked out of him by Lou, who owns the kind of bar, and they're fighting underneath, and he jumps on top of him and just starts bleeding all over him. And, you know, that's pretty, pretty grim, pretty edgy. It's a film that dices with suicide, particularly with Marla and overdosing. And then there's a lot of violence when Edward Norton's character, I think, who's the blonde guys, it's famous actor, it's Jared Leto. So, and he feels jealous of him because he feels like Tyler's picked him over himself, which is crazy because he's basically jealous of himself, which is weird. He's jealous, you know, it's a weird, that part is a quite strange element of it. And he kicks the shit out of him in Fight Club. He wants to destroy something beautiful, is what he says, you know?
Yeah.
And that kind of edge to him where he's really on the edge of psychotic and unstable completely, and his mind's almost gone. And then he kind of comes to a realization that, you know, after Bob's death, really, you know, that's kind of what triggers it for him.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
You know, he comes to a kind of a waking conclusion that it's not just a game anymore. It's a life and death situation. So, yeah, I mean, there's loads of untones. Again, like Zodiac, we could probably talk Well, I could clearly talk all day and use Incredible World about 4,000 times, but it's iconic, like Trainspotting, as you mentioned, and it's a film that will always remain in my kind of my most memorable, most iconic films for me in my whole lifetime. So, yeah, wins for me. I'm going to do a couple of questions, and then Luke, I'll give you a little bit of a soapbox for Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and then we'll briefly kind of talk on Seven. So the questions I got asked, and I'm remarkably unprepared. Give me a second. There's a couple of good ones. One that a good friend Harinder Singh asked about Fincher using Brad Pitt a lot in his films. I think directors tend to do that. I think if you look at Nolan's work with using Michael Caine, using Cillian Murphy in most of his films, obviously got a kind of strong nuance for using Christian Bale with The Prestige and obviously Batman films. And, you know, there'll be others to come. You look at modern Scorsese using DiCaprio in everything you can work with him on, really. And, you know, directors, what they do is they find an actor that get their vision and work well with them, and maybe it works in conjunction. You find that I think a director often gets the best out of an actor. Maybe an actor, you know, pushes a director in, you know, and that kind of partnership really does work. So, you know, Brad Pitt for me has done most of his best work when he's with Fincher. And I think it might not happen again, but I'd like to see it at some stage, because I think Brad Pitt has still got a lot to offer as an actor. He doesn't always pick bold choices anymore. He's gone through a kind of up and down patch of films, and yeah, it'd be nice to see him do something that's a little bit more, you know, extreme as such.
I think just on that point, so I was obviously just doing my research, which basically involved Googling David Fincher 5 minutes before we did the show.
Nice,
but
nice.
He's slated to do World War Z too with Brad Pitt.
Yeah. Oh yeah, so, that's been
so that'll be interesting.
I like that film as well. Fast zombies normally annoy me, but actually it kind of works.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting. I think it almost have maybe ran its course for me. Like, I enjoyed the first one, I could rewatch it, but I didn't think it had much more in it, like in the bank. But it's almost like it's been given a kind of a rebirth if Fincher's taken it on, because then you kind of think, well, that's going to get your kind of your core film fans back involved.
It'll be a rebirth entirely. Yeah. It won't really be the same. And also, it'll have a good script attached to it, which will help.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I just thought I'd just chirp in there. So I'm not Brad Pitt, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's interesting. Actually, yeah, World War Z was probably one of his better films, Brad Pitt, and he carried that film at times. It's,
recent
times, anyway. Few questions from Simba242, who I chat with quite regularly, really good taste. Fight Club best scene has to be the self-fight in IKEA furnishings, which I really like, the IKEA furnishings. Again, really good visual where they're kind of filling the room with the catalogue pages. I think it looks great. Bromance with Brad Pitt. Yeah, that's good for us. Favourite David movie? I think we like them all, but we're talking a little bit on that. Like the use of his silhouettes in his movies. I think, Simon, you talked a bit on that some stage in the last pod. Maybe not quite.
Near enough to it, yeah.
Yeah, we kind of got that impression.
Played in around
his films. Does he have a weird fascination about suicide? Or do they make for good endings? I think they make for damn good endings. Happy endings, are they overrated? Because his villains seem to win. They are overrated. I think Hollywood has a fascination with happy endings. And occasionally it's nice for molds to be broken. I will mention La La Land again, only because it's a very typically heavy romantic kind of film where everyone expected a typical ending and it had completely reverse of that. And that's quite rare in those kind of films. I think, you know, you have directors going out of the way to be controversial and do, you know, random endings that don't always work out. But I think Fincher kind of knows exactly. I don't know if he's a director that works in reverse. I know a lot of directors work from the end of the film and then kind of work backwards because they know exactly how they want it, boldness to end, and then kind of work from there. I think it's a good point to talk about Seven which probably has one of the boldest endings, almost iconic endings of all time, with the sentiments from Brad Pitt, "What's in the box?" Seven's an incredible film. I've not really talked about Spacey since what came out about Spacey. It does make you look at him in a slightly different light. Personally, I look back at Baby Driver and see things a little bit differently. And I'm not sure, that's maybe a topic for another, another pod, really. But
yeah,
looking back at this performance in Seven, he plays a psychotic lunatic, obsessed with, you know, the seven deadly sins. And maybe it's fitting because he's not the nicest of men in real life.
Not a good dude.
Seven is a film full of bold situations. Morgan Freeman is incredible, as I keep saying, but he's an astonishing performance from him. And it's quite a young Brad Pitt, and it's quite a new performance for him. And I thought he was really interesting in this and intriguing, but Spacey does steal the show in this. And that scene at the end, I mean, Christ, what a scene. I was blown away when I watched that for the first time. And I still am, to be honest. If you watch that back, it still gets me every time because you know what's going to happen, but there's no stopping that emotional reaction from Brad Pitt. Luke, do you remember it the first time?
No, honestly, I remember I saw it when I was like really quite young. Probably too young to watch it.
Probably
really
too young. Yeah.
And I only remember the end scene, like in the vast nothingness. I think it is, and that's kind of what I remember. And it was one of them. I think you could, like, I had quite a big Fincher binge today, and most of the films I watched were kind of ones I'd seen before or ones that I knew, like we were chatting about. But you'll always miss them, and you'll always kind of, there'll be films that you've not quite seen as many times as you'd like to of his, and that's probably one of them. And that, I mean, I reckon if, you know, come back to me in a week and I'll have seen that again. I think I'm really interested in it because it goes down. I think it's like kind of a thriller for like the ages almost. So I'm big into like my horror and thriller films. So like I'll definitely be picking up on that and changing that fact quite soon. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a film you do need to. It's hard to remember what goes on because I think that end scene steals most of your memory. You know, Everyone remembers what's in the box scene, and even if I was looking at GIFs and images and famous stuff today, it's always about that scene.
Yeah,
but all the seven deadly sins are highlighted in that film, and there's a couple of scenes that the hallway scene where they almost catch Spacey and go to his apartment. Real tension in that. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of lesser stated scenes in this film. It's not as bold as maybe some of his later work. And it's a really interesting story. And the narrative around Morgan Freeman and mentoring this younger kind of detective and their relationship. Yeah, it's an astonishing piece of film making. And it is, like you said, one for the ages. I think it's a thriller that is almost defining in that genre. Simon, what's your take as a whole?
It's great. I mean, it's kind of one of those films that you don't think about it for a while, and you just go, oh, yeah, I must watch that film again. And every time I watch the film, I'm just blown away by it. I mean, it is definitely probably one of the best thrillers I think ever made. I mean, you could definitely make a pretty good argument for it being that. It definitely defined thrillers for me. I mean, when was it out? What year was it released?
95.
Yeah,
yeah. So I would have been definitely far too young when it was first out. So I probably saw
it then. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say I probably would have seen it somewhere around the 2000s. And I just it's very, very dark. It's bold.
I would have got it when shock. I first watched it. I think I loved, but I think I was it was too dark. I mean, even as a probably a 18-year-old.
Yeah,
you know, it was one of those films that was kind of sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. It was kind of one of those films that was almost banned, wasn't it? You know, like it was like don't watch that film type of thing.
Yeah, it had that around it. Yeah, and I think I was like we said, we're all probably a little bit too young for the initial reaction to it. Because it probably did have a lot of buzz and a lot of hype, and you know, it's the kind of film that people remember that one scene, but like like I said, the whole film is a masterpiece in thriller direction. Yeah. It really is, and it builds that tension, and you really didn't expect to the end. And yeah, I think it's incredible. And I've said that word again. Fuck. I'm not listening back to this because I'll just be, it'd be like the incredible drinking game where you just have to, I'm not going to cover that Pixar film.
Don't do the incredible, I was going to say.
Yeah, I'm not going to cover that sequel that's coming out later by Pixar this year. Luke, I'll let you talk a film that I really, really, really need to rewatch, which is Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. I remember when I first saw it, there's a couple of scenes in this that were extremely shocking. And I know that's from the book and obviously the original kind of Scandi film that was made. But I thought the performance in this, again, kind of different cast, which was good because it felt fresh and quite new. But I love the Scandi noir stuff, and I know a lot of people are obsessed with it. And this film just had that, but with Fincher's kind of trademark style.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that probably kept me or attracted me to the film. I've been to kind of Scandinavia a few times, and it does have a soft spot with me. And I think as an in to the film, as soon as you kind of start it, for me, that's kind of what attracted me and kind of kept me going, I think, like at the beginning almost. But I think the whole film in general, it's really interesting. There's some typically Fincher kind of very, very dark, gory themes in there, especially with there's the guy who's kind of looking after the money of the main protagonist, which is Rooney Mara, and I'm not gonna begin to pronounce her name because I'm pretty sure it's like hardcore Scandinavian. Anyway, there's that quite dark element, but I just think it's really, really interesting because it isn't particularly, I don't think it's particularly complicated. It's a straightforward film, isn't it? I think although there's some twists and turns, and there is, that it's definitely like whodunit almost, but I think it develops into kind of, it does morph into that kind of Zodiac kind of the detective-esque feel to it. But I just think it feels really fresh. Again, I think it's in that kind of core Fincher films around, like between probably Zodiac and Gone Girl, where it's very simple, very, very, very cool in its own way. And I think considering it was taken off of like a very critically successful original book and obviously original Swedish film, I think to do that, and a lot of them are kind of Hollywood-esque or Hollywood-style films that do that, it falls flat. I'm just thinking of Wreck straight off the bat. The American version of that was just absolute pants. And I think I will make a rule generally not to rewatch Hollywood versions of foreign language films, but this one is a complete exception for me. Not too complicated, not, you know, I don't think it is, whereas you've got with Fight Club especially, I think you kind of got to be there, haven't you? You've got, your mind's got to be there. It's almost very Hollywood, I think, for Fincher, but not in a bad way, not in a bad way. And I really like it. Like it is honestly up there for me with The Social Network, because I do like them, like the new, so they say new, it's not a new, is it? But
no,
new
Fincher
films, yeah.
So
I mean, I think what, so if you've seen it once, Rory, what was your take initially?
I've seen it a couple of times. I've seen it a couple of times, and I think I had seen the original. I'll be honest, for a while, the rape scene is pretty harrowing in that film. Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit hard to see past it, because there are scenes in certain films, and I'm doing and I'll talk about it more on a different pod, but what I'm doing at the minute is watching 100 original films I've never seen before. And I'm really enjoying it. And it's something a couple of cool guys did on Twitter last year, and I kept seeing them do it. And there's always films that you haven't seen. And there's films that I had seen, but far too young to really properly absorb it and remember it. So I've gone back and watching stuff. And there's a couple of films. There's an Australian film called... Oh, God, it's not going to help when I don't remember the name of it. I'm just going to look at my list. That's got a quite... I'm not going to spoil that, actually. I'll come back and talk about it another day. It's a film that I think people should watch. It's been made into a TV show, and it is called Animal Kingdom. It's got really... Really good Australian cast in it. And it's quite dark, and there's one scene in particular which... which kind of shocked me and left me a little bit numb to it. And I think the first time I watched Girl with Dragon Tattoo, although it ramps up and it's such a cool film and all the tension and you know, even if you know the outcome, you don't really know the outcome. You know, it still keeps you on tenterhooks. I thought it was incredible the first time, but second time I maybe got past that scene a little bit more and enjoyed it, I think, more still. I do really need to watch it since. I've only seen it a couple of times. It's, again, trademark Fincher. I can see why he's taking it on. A bit like you said, modern films. Gone Girl's got a kind of modern...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Feel to it as well from a Fincher kind of point of view. And I like the films he's making now, and I like that he's going into doing some telly and some slightly different angles of stuff, because you want we talked about evolution of directors, and I think it's important that they do that. I think this was quite a big film in a step in the different direction, because
for sure
he makes original films and original TV shows, and to do something that's been done before is quite it feels out of character for him, you know. He doesn't seem to want to tread on other directors' paths, and I'm sure if you spoke to him, and I've heard interviews with him, he would give you a long list of people he'd taken inspiration from in his career and growing up, and writers and other directors and producers and things. But it's rare for a film to be made so recently after the other one had been done, and in what is a similar enough style, but just he's just done it in a retelling in a way that I think he thought he could add enough to it to make it different, and he does.
And
Daniel Craig's excellent, Rooney Mara is really good, and all the kind of Scandi cast in there. Can't remember who's the chief antagonist, but he's a really good actor. And a lot of those actors are getting big parts, because a lot
they are now.
It's coming in that you know realm. A lot more things are shot in that Scandi noir kind of way. In that, I understand why. A film from last year, which is American, Wind River, is all about snow. And it's a different film, but it's got that kind of American stroke Scandi noir feel to it. I kind of highly recommend that. It's a really good film, and it's not similar impact to this. This is a lot grittier, and there's a lot darker kind of undertones. But that's it. That's a good film, and it you see that kind of influence now into the way films are shot in the States. And it's nice that Hollywood does take on board other influences. I know the UK is big in its film production now, and that's well respected, but there's a lot of films from all over the world that need to be kind of watched and heard. And I think that the hyper-armed Girl with a Dragon Tattoo originally is what took it that way, and I think it's only bettered it, really. I think this film is excellent. Sam, we'll touch on you before we wrap.
Yeah, I thought it was great as well. As you kind of mentioned there, it definitely feels like it was a new direction for him. It feels a lot more modern as well. I thought, just even the way it was filmed, like you can definitely tell that there's a lot more just modern techniques in a crisp, clean, and where it's filmed, there's some just beautiful shots, and the locations are fantastic.
It was up for an Oscar for cinematography.
Yeah,
I see why. It won an Oscar for film editing. And like you said, there is that to it. Those locations and the way it's shot, it's different, isn't it? It's different from Fincher.
Yeah. It did have, as Luke said, it kind of had the same, kind of some of the same elements that Zodiac had, just that it had those bits where they were doing the kind of the procedural kind of bits that went on for a bit and where there wasn't a lot of kind of action, but then it did get it. I think it kind of had that kind of a feel to it, but it just felt a lot cleaner, I think, or something.
To do with the snow as well.
The white everywhere, and it was,
I'm with you completely. It's interesting, like you said, IMDb just looked at the guy who won the Oscar, Angus Wall, and he's worked on like Game of Thrones and Social Network and Fight Club and a film called Voyeur and Icarus and some interesting projects. And they do, man. It's not just what a director influences on the film. Everyone will talk about cinematographers, and the only one they know is usually Roger Deakins, who might finally win an Oscar for Blade Runner 2049. And it's been up loads of times but never won for a lot of other things. And you notice that with a director when they start working with different people, or when they work with the same person like Nolan does. I can't remember who Nolan's cinematographer is, but it's someone that he uses all the time. And you can just tell, because they've got that complementary style. But this, for me, because Fincher films are always notorious for being in the States and a lot around buildings and not about landscapes. You know what I mean? It's always about streets and buildings, and it's never really about more open areas. And I think that was what felt different to this, because Scandinavia and the snow and the housing and everything, nothing alike to American streets, you know, and suburbs. So yeah, it did feel a distinctly different film. It had a few Zodiac kind of moments to it for me in terms of the way it was shot, and I could see that influence. But yeah, again, I'm all for more of this. As you can always tell, I'm a huge fan of David Fincher, as I think we all kind of clearly are. And the more you talk about him, the more you kind of feel like he does influence maybe the films I like in particular, but also the kind of films that he, I think, has inspired other directors to make, because that's definitely the case. He's referenced by so many people as having such an influence on the way things are done. You look at Get Out, which I hope does well at the Oscars, and it's obviously got that horror kind of dark comedy kind of mix, but there's definitely, I don't know, felt like there's Fincher undertones to that film. And you know, it, you watch films now through that reference point, well, I do anyway. And you can just kind of see that influence from pioneering directors. It's been nice to discuss this. This is a big opening two pods for me. A little bit nervous coming into this, because I've obviously said one word in particularly a lot, because I'm probably a little bit nervous, which isn't like me, because I clearly love to talk about film. But as I said at the beginning of the kind of first pod, it's a big thing for me coming on to do this. Part it's something I've wanted to do, but would never have dreamt of, kind of, you know, always just happy to be involved. And I made my debut doing podcasting going back about 2.5 years when I came on to do Shawshank, and Joe forced me basically to come on and talk about Shawshank Redemption, which I absolutely loved. And since then I've gone on to do a comic pod, which I am still doing, and just other things. And it's given me kind of confidence to do that. And I, you know, like meeting new people, talking to new people. And I think Twitter is a great place to socially interact about films and television and not just football, because people just lose their head over things like that. It's nice to talk about the things that you meet people like these two guys that you have a common invested interest in, and then it develops into more than that. And it's the same with Stu and me on the comic pod, because it's two guys that have a similar influence, and off to his wedding in next month, and you know, we're really close mates, and it's good what it does for people. So I really love all the interaction. I love all the kind of people that have got in touch and congratulated me and you know, give me the vote of confidence and stuff, which I really appreciate. And like I said, you know, there's some excellent, if you want to go back and listen to the stuff Joe's produced before, he does some really good takes on some really classic films. I've been really lucky to be involved in a lot of those. And you know, appreciate all the kind of feedback and stuff for these pods and the direction we're moving forward. We're covering Tarantino next in a couple of weeks, hopefully. Again, will be quite a long podcast or two, I would imagine. It's hard with directors that are this prominent because they obviously produce so many quality films. And looking at maybe Villeneuve and a couple of different things, and maybe soundtracks in films and trilogies and childhood classics. And there's a lot of stuff that I've wanted to talk about for a long time, and we'll get to do. I just want to thank you two for coming on. Genuinely appreciate your time and all your thoughts and open my mind up to a few different things that I hadn't thought about, which is always great for me.
Yes, Alan, my pleasure.
Thanks a million for having us, Rory. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, thanks, mate.
Enjoyed it.
Oh, no, it's really good. And I did think of you two quite early to coming on, and I know you'll be on a lot in the future. And I like to, like I said, talk to people that, you know, again, it's all influence. So it's not, you know, with films and stuff, I'm not a stubborn guy. I'll watch films if people recommend them. And the 100 films thing I'm doing, which I've got lists of and it's on my Twitter page, I love, because I'm watching things like South Korean cinema and Japanese films and, you know, foreign language films and films that you kind of on the edge of watching and then have not for one reason or another. I watched Rush most recently and I thought that was excellent. And you watch films that maybe you know, you just kind of had not considered at one point or another and just not done. And it's a cool thing to do, and it's nice to be open and honest and just say, yeah, hold my hands up and I didn't watch this. Don't shoot me. I will watch it. and it's been fun. It's been fun. So I'll continue to do that. And I will be back with you in a couple of weeks, probably discussing Tarantino and, again, just going a bit crazy for some incredible films that he's produced. Take it easy. We will catch up with you soon. Thanks.
Stop.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.